Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and this show tonight is sponsored by the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Our guest tonight is Dr. Charles Tart, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, our toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Bob, what's on your mind today?
I don't think we've done in our interview show since the grief retreat, so I just want to mention that.
Well, the grief retreat, we actually had a gathering.
At the retreat,
yeah.
We haven't really talked about it, but for those who attended, it was great seeing you, and if you didn't, perhaps you would be able to attend the future one, but it's always a blessing in these things when you see the effect that people can have by learning and exploring, you know, and sharing. And one thing that I noticed, I don't know if you noticed it as well, is that as we've done many of these retreats, there always seem to be a handful of people that go to the retreat for reasons that they're not, we can't really understand it. They get like a sudden urge to go.
Mm-hmm.
They're not members of the foundation, but, you know, all of a sudden they see a flyer or, you know, a friend.
And they need to go there. And they change their whole schedule just to be there.
Right. But not only that, but then I noticed that it's usually these people that have the most profound experiences, you know, at the retreat.
Right.
Which leads me to believe that, and, you know, perhaps it's orchestrated.
There's a higher force.
They were guided, you know, to be there. And I mean, people might say, well, how do you get guided, you know, to go to something like that? Well, you know, maybe a thought was put into their head, or maybe a thought was put into a friend's head, you know, to let them know about it, or you know, just things that happen that appear to be happenstance that are part of a bigger pattern. So
right.
You agree?
Oh, yeah. We see it pretty much year after year after year. There's always at least one story like that emerges each time. And I, you know, what's interesting is they're small events. There's only, you know, a limited number of people who are there. And so that's also very interesting how each one fills up and you know, it's the people that are meant to be there. It just seems to be, and they all get to know each other, and they're all of like minds, and they have each other. It's also almost like a little support group within itself for the weekend.
Then you wonder how it plays out in everyday life. You know, how many, when we make decisions to do something, you know, how many of these decisions are based on thought and reasoning versus our gut?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when you think of how mediums train new mediums, they almost always start with just say the first thing that pops into your mind when you're trying to read someone. And isn't that the same thing? You're allowing a thought to come in and guide you or give you information or take you down the pathway that you have to go. And we're so detached from how our inner selves work that we don't notice it happening.
Yeah, and we talk about, it's interesting, the term that we use, you know, gut reactions, you know, which we use interchangeably with instinct. And now science is telling us that, and a lot of progressive thinking health practitioners are saying that the gut may play a bigger role in our development and our thinking than the brain does. I mean, there's more neural networks.
Some of them call it the second brain.
Yeah.
Some of them call it the first brain, and the brain that we've known is the second brain.
Right. So, you know, the brain is not manufacturing all these experiences. You know, the brain, you know, just facilitates these things. And by the same token, the gut may receive information from non-physical sources. We call it instinct. You know,
right.
But in a similar fashion to what we think it's the brain, it could be the gut all along. You know,
it could be. And interestingly enough, a lot of mediums before an event won't eat. Won't eat because they say it influences their ability to communicate.
I saw that you had an article there that was interesting about animals and grief.
Yeah.
A lot of people would say to you, well, you know, grief is a human emotion.
Right, and many scientists say that too. But if you talk to a lot of people who have pets, multiple pets, and if one pet dies, the other pet starts acting differently. So that there is something that goes on. But I had pulled out this article, which included some research on animals and whether or not they perform in a way that would be attributed to a grief process, because obviously they can't ask the animal what they're feeling. But they've checked in with chimpanzees and elephants and a few other species, and you know, it's funny because you read through the whole article, and the scientists really are still on the fence, because they do notice behavior that is easily attributed to grief in these particular species. But then they're saying that they can't draw an absolute conclusion, because what drives an animal to do something is not necessarily the same thing that drives a human to do something.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they exhibited some similar behavior, you know, perhaps in, you know, lack of activity, or their eating patterns are off and things like that. But who's to say that, for instance, in that chimpanzee study that, you know, that the chimps are not able to communicate with their lost loved ones the same way the humans do?
Right, they did.
They can't go to a medium, per se, but they have to do it on their own.
Maybe they do. Maybe they have their own chimp mediums. But they do say there are accounts of chimps and other primates refusing to put down the bodies of dead babies and holding them for days until the body begins to decompose. So there's that need to hold on to something physical. And again, you can't necessarily attribute that to grief. You know, there's the argument that animals operate on a higher telepathic and knowing level than we do, because they're not so influenced by the physical world. So maybe that's just a physical response to the loss of the physical body, or they're holding on to the body for some other reason, maybe so that another animal doesn't come and eat the body or whatever that is. But the chimpanzees that they've watched, they still can't absolutely conclude that it is because of grief that they're holding on to those babies. And the same thing with elephants that stand around a fellow elephant that has died or has been attacked by another animal. So this goes on and on, but when you go back to house pets, cats and dogs, we hear stories over and over and over again of how if one cat dies, the other cat in the household will stop eating, or if the dog dies, the other dog is moping around. So there's something that goes on, but personally, my observation is it's on a different level. I think that they operate on a higher spiritual level than we do, so they know that they've graduated, gone on to a better place, and I think it's just some other reaction they're having to the physical body not being there anymore.
That's interesting. We're going to have a great guest tonight, a legend in the field of parapsychology, Dr. Charles Tartt. So we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to get Dr. Charlie Tartt on the line with us. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perazzetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the ForeverFamilyFoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
Those just tuning in, we have been talking with Dr. Charles. We're our guest tonight is Dr. Charles Tartt. Our sponsor tonight is the Camlack Center, and they can be found on the web at camlack.com. That's K-A-M-L-A-K.com. Bob?
And we're very happy to have Dr. Charles Tart with us again. It's been quite a while. Charles is internationally known for his psychological work on the nature of consciousness, as one of the founders of the field of transpersonal psychology, and for his research in parapsychology. Dr. Tart studied electrical engineering at MIT before deciding to become a psychologist. He received his PhD in psychology from the University of North Carolina, with research on influencing nighttime dreams by post-hypnotic suggestions, and then received postdoctoral training in hypnosis research at Stanford. He is Professor Emeritus at Sophia University, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of California, Davis. He consulted on the original remote viewing research program at Stanford Research Institute, where some of his work was important in influencing government policymakers against the deployment of the multi-billion-dollar MX missile system. Dr. Tart has published more than 250 articles in professional journals. He's written many classic books. His latest we're going to discuss tonight, The Secret Science of the Soul, How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. And we could say that his primary goal is to build bridges between scientific and spiritual communities and to help integrate Western and Eastern approaches for knowing the world and for personal and social growth. Website, you're probably better off Googling Charles Tart, but I'll tell you, it's paradigm-sys.com. Well, welcome to the show again, Dr. Tart.
Good to be here, Bob. Kind of fatiguing to hear all that stuff, though. Makes me tired.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you have an illustrious career that you've had over the years. So you've lived most of your adult life as both a scientist and a spiritual seeker. And to many, those two terms would seem contradictory. You know, they might view a scientific view as being the polar opposite of spiritual contemplation. So why do you think that is? Why is that the general perception?
Well, that's actually a confusion about what science is, and it's such a widespread confusion that an awful lot of scientists are confused, too.
Hmm.
Okay? To me, science is a method. It's a way of starting from, you kind of know some things, but maybe some of it's wrong, but you want to get clearer on what actually happens and why it seems to happen that way. At any given time, you have some ideas of how it works. But then if you keep doing the method, you keep clarifying things. But people think what we know at the moment is the final answer. You know, we like success. When people started to think that the mind was like a telephone switchboard, they thought, wow, we've got it together. But, you know, if that's the way you think it is now, you're kind of ignoring the last 50 years.
Mm.
So, you know, I don't take the spiritual as to mean there's this revealed truth and it's absolutely right and that's the end of it. I think it's people trying to make sense out of deep spiritual experiences, and we can always look more closely at what they actually experienced, how they attempted to make some sense out of it and communicate it to the rest of us, and we can make progress in spirituality.
Hmm.
Incidentally, I love to kid some of my friends who are kind of conventionally religious by asking them, has there been any progress in spirituality and religion in the past 100 years? They look at me like I'm nuts.
I would imagine so. And, you know, you mentioned spirituality and religion. A lot of people use those terms interchangeably. They don't see any difference between the two. Do you?
Well, of course, a lot of people do use them interchangeably, but I make a difference that spirituality is about kind of the raw experiences people have, and then committees are formed and they make arrangements with the local authorities and they turn it into a set of doctrines that support the current system, and you've got religion. And I'm more of a loner going back to look at the individual experiences people have instead of what the committees have worked out. And I hate committee work. You know, religion tends to be more a matter of this is the way it is, do it or else. Spirituality is open opening up, finding out sort of stuff. But people use it in all sorts of ways. That's just the way I distinguish them.
Yeah. Well, I suppose one makes their own rules in spirituality, whereas they have to conform to rules in formal religion. You know, perhaps that's the way I think of it.
Yeah. You know, like one of the most profound spiritual experiences happened to people who have a near-death experience, and then they try to make sense of it afterwards, and they may spend 10, 20 years trying to make sense out of all that happened to them in a five-minute experience. But it's important to try to make sense of it and to try to live it, but it ain't easy.
Mm. You know, I find it curious, like over the years, that how many people think of things that you study, you know, psi, non-local phenomena, they put it in a spirituality box. In other words, if it doesn't make sense to them due to their education and their beliefs, that the unexplainable must have some sort of a spiritual explanation. So, I mean, do you think it's a mistake for people to think of what?
Oh, yeah. Some things are unexplainable because we're just not smart enough to figure them out. They may or may not have anything to do with spirituality. But that's why I think we need to do a wider science to figure things out.
Yeah, well, so when we think of mediumship, for example, you know, which very well may involve telepathy, just one, you know, between a living person and a non-living person. You know, a lot of people also consider mediumship to be a spiritual endeavor. But it may just be an ability that's inherent to us all, as opposed to putting some divine significance to it.
Yeah, and that would be interesting to find out. For instance, you know, we assume that mediums are people who are pretty rare. They have some special talent. But, of course, it's not as if we go through and give people vocational aptitude tests and tell 10% of them, you ought to try being a medium and see how many can be trained to be very good at it. We don't really know how widespread an ability like that is.
Mm. So I remember, you know, from reading your books, you know, years ago, you know, you explain the difference between science and scientism. And scientism can be pretty bad thing in the overall picture when it comes to discovery and exploration. So for our listeners, how would you explain the difference between science and scientism?
Well, for what I think of as the basic scientific process, it starts out with curiosity. You know, you'd like to know who you are, what the world is, and all that. And you have some ideas, but you're not satisfied that you know all that much. You genuinely want to learn some stuff. That's the important place to begin with. So you go out and you gather experience, maybe you do some experiments and check with other authorities and so forth, and you try to refine that knowledge. Of course, it's very important knowledge, right? You know, religion and spirituality are not just a curious thing that doesn't affect our life. It affects the way we live. So when you find an appealing understanding, there's a tendency to grab onto it and to get too attached to it, you know. All right, now I've got the truth, all in capital letters. Well, that stops curiosity. That stops being open to new experience and evolving and so forth. And I understand it. You know, we don't have time to play scientists all the time. We want to find something that makes sense of our lives and live it. But it's good that we have a few people who work as scientists and are trying to figure out what it means. Can we get better understandings?
Right.
I mean, you know, if I took the religion I was taught as a childhood and said, is that it? I'd be very disappointed. It was kind of rigid. It wasn't very nice to people. The God I was talked about in church, you know, he doesn't come up to my standards of what a God should be anymore. But I think spirituality is about something more than that.
So you could be a closed-minded scientist the same way you could be a closed-minded skeptic. I mean,
yeah. And that's where scientism comes in. You take some particular findings of science and assume that's the final answer, And you get attached to that, and then you start defending that point of view instead of going on to explore it, expand it, test it, and whatnot. And once the curiosity is gone, you get into all sorts of common human behaviors where you've got doctrines, you argue with other people who don't agree with you, and so forth. So it's more interesting to keep asking questions.
Yeah, I mean, closed-mindedness, you know, is such a deterrent to personal growth or exploration. I'm sensitive to all this because I know that my life today is a lot different than it was 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years ago, I would have said that, logic told me that we are our brains. Our brains produce consciousness, and when our brains die, you know, we're extinguished, and that's it. And any suggestion otherwise was preposterous. And, of course, now... I laugh when I think of what my prior life was. So I mean, but you've been dealing with people that think that way your whole career, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Not only are you among the general public, but your colleagues, right? Have you experienced much judgment and I'll say ridicule from people that think they know more than you?
And not just ridicule, but people who try to stop my research, to make it more difficult for me to do that sort of thing and so forth, because they feel that having a wider view of a universe where there's something to the spiritual is somehow threatening to what we already know. It's not threatening. You know, I mean, the materialistic science stuff we have now, it's wonderful. I mean, we're able to talk all the way across the country. That's fantastic. It's just that you mustn't let it cement you into a very narrow view of things. We build on that. It's wonderful. I love gadgets and material stuff.
Yeah.
But it's like that's... In fact, so I've been just having a discussion with people, and materialism is basically a tool. You know, it's a way of saying, I think it would be good to figure out the universe in terms of little things that get built up into bigger things, and how many things can we explain that way? Well, that's all right. We leads to a lot of useful gadgets and so forth. But to then say, that's the only way it makes any sense to think about things. No, come on, folks. We got wider talents than that.
Mentioned in the book, this Secret Science of the Soul, you told a story about a personal experience, and I related to that because there were times in my life for no apparent reason that I blurted out a particular phrase, and I couldn't figure out why. And then I read you had an experience like that with you said the phrase coup d'état.
Coup d'état, yeah. I'll tell that story. I'd been working one morning at my office at home, and I needed some coffee, so I'm up waiting for some water to boil at the stove, and I suddenly find that I'm standing there saying, coup d'etat, coup d'etat, coup d'etat. And I'm interested in understanding my own mind, so I thought, that's funny. I don't think I've ever said that word in my life, okay? But coup d'etat, that's about revolutions that happen in South America or something, which is not of interest to me. And I couldn't understand why I was saying it. So, you know, I took note of it, and my coffee was ready. I went back to work. And the next day I went into my office, and there is a letter from a Mrs. Coup d'etat who was concerned that her son, who was in my altered states class, might be getting some funny ideas. Oh, okay. Mrs. Coup d'etat was thinking about me, trying to communicate with me. My mind was sort of open as I was just sort of waiting for the coffee to be ready. I guess that was probably telepathy. Now, I wouldn't cite that as proof of anything. You know, it's just one instance.
Right.
But it's the kind of thing actually that tells you that telepathy might be more likely to happen when your mind is sort of blank and open rather than all busy with your regular tasks or something.
Hmm. So you can't really force telepathy. People have, when you play these games, not in a research setting, but even among friends, and you're trying to do a telepathy game, people try to, you know, really concentrate hard to send the message. But you're suggesting perhaps it works better if you just, like, throw it out there and then, you know, throw it out in the universe and see what happens.
Well, you know, if I ask you, Bob, reach up and tap your fingers on the top of your head, you could do that. That's a minor variation on something you've had a skill at doing for a zillion years. But if I say, read my mind or send a telepathic message, I think an intelligent response would be, huh? Do what?
Right.
It's not enough to test telepathy, and some of my own research was based on this very idea. We need to start training people to figure out how to use telepathy and how it works for a particular individual person. What's something that's reasonably successful for one person might be a total waste of time for somebody else. For instance, for years, the standard laboratory test was guessing at the order of shuffled decks of cards. And that's kind of interesting and exciting the first time you did it. You know, and by the 50th time you've done it, it's really pretty dull. And I find it amazing that some people were able to even get some extra hits from telepathy or clairvoyance in a situation like that. We can kind of give something some importance if we want to, but it's hard to hold it up. But what works for people? So, you know, as I mentioned in the Secret Science of the Soul book, some of my research for a few years was trying to teach people how to use telepathy by putting them in a situation which seemed kind of elementary to me, of letting them make tries at doing it, but then getting immediate feedback whether they were right or wrong. So my picture of what happened is they'd eventually sort of build up a catalog in my head, you know. Whenever I feel like this and make a response, I'm always wrong. Maybe from now on when I feel that way, I shouldn't even try. I should just relax. When I do it this other way, I'm right more than I should be by chance. Let me try to understand that better. And I had some indications that it looked like you could do it this way. And then I ran out of research funding for it and got involved in the remote viewing stuff, and so never really followed it up. Maybe I was getting a little bored with repeated guessing like that, too.
Yeah. Well, you did certainly change the game a bit because, you know, you were, I think, the first really to suggest that, you know, you try to incorporate learning into the protocol. So is Psi something that can be learned or improved as opposed to just some innate ability?
Well, I certainly thought so, or I wouldn't have bothered with the experiment.
Right.
And, of course, I could be wrong. And it probably matters what an individual person is like, you know. Like, a lot of people can be taught to sing opera. If somebody tried to teach me to sing opera, I think they couldn't stand by attempts to be melodious like that. So one of the things I added in my learning theory, which people seem determined not to pay attention to, is when you're trying to learn something, you've got to have some talent to begin with, so there's something that actually happens that gives you clues as to how to do it. If you have no talent to begin with, I don't expect the learning procedure to do much good. And my research supported that general idea also. People with more talent to begin with showed more increase in their abilities.
You know, in one of the parts of the book, you wrote about an experiment that you helped conduct in 1972. And I think you even mentioned that you forgot about it, which I found, how could you forget about something like this? But you had a participant that was in
which,
a...
Which experiment was that? I don't remember it yet.
you were in a, you had the subject in a shielded Faraday cage, influencing the spinning coin, and it landed on heads 100 times in 100 attempts.
Now,
That is so incredulous. I mean, when you see something like that that defies logic, don't you want to just scream that from the rooftops? Isn't it frustrating that people just, you know, shelve the information and dismiss it?
Well, it's frustrating, but it's also a complicated sort of thing because, you know, one of the things I've tried to do a little research on is that I think in some ways we're scared of psychic stuff.
I agree.
Who wants to admit that? You know, I'm a big, tough he-man. I'm not scared of anything.
Right.
But why did I forget that for years until I happened to consult my notes years later and see that? very funny stuff. Most people, are, let's say for some people who deny that there's anything to psychic abilities, there may be a fear factor in there. They may be afraid that people would then know things about them that they wouldn't want them to know or the like. Again, a lot of individual reasons, but it's not a simple emotionally neutral kind of thing to learn that. You know, it's not been that long since we burnt people at the stake that we thought it had psychic abilities.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? We are talking with Dr. Charles Tart. The book is The Secret Science of the Soul, How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. We have a lot more to talk about. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking more with Dr. Charles Tart. Stay with us.
The CAMLAC Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the CAMLAC Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlac.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
Am I Psychic is a mobile app designed using statistics, science, and parapsychological protocols to test psychic ability using fun games. Each game has two unique modes. In psychokinesis mode, influence the game using mind over matter ability. In extrasensory perception mode, guess which random option will be chosen. Am I Psychic can store your results in an anonymous database used to eventually publish in academic journals. Available on the App Store and Google Play. Go to ampsychicapp.com and be a part of proving psychic phenomena to the world. Some profits will be donated to the Ryan Research Center.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
We all grieve in different ways, and let's face it, grief hurts. Losing a loved one is usually the hardest event we will ever face. We can throw our hands up and become hardened by our grief, or we can take positive steps to transform it. Love Knows No Death, a groundbreaking and powerful grief transformation method, can be what you've been looking for to provide some peace and understanding. It was created and written by medical doctor and professor Dr. Piero Calvi Perissetti, and it's a combination of a self-help workbook and video course. The workbook has the power to lessen grief and foster significant healing, and has already helped countless people to not only lead productive lives, but to do so with the knowledge that they will indeed see their loved ones again. The workbook can be purchased for $19.95 on Amazon or on the foreverfamilyfoundation.org grief and loss page, where a digital version is also available for $9.95. Love knows no death. Truer words have never been spoken.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you are just tuning in, we have been talking with Dr. Charles Tart. Our sponsor is the Comlock Center, and they can be found on the web at comlock.com. And here are some updates now on the Forever Family Foundation events and happenings. We want to remind all of our listeners to check the events page on our website regularly as things change. That's foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Just to let our listeners know about our free events coming up this next month, since we're at the end of the month, February 10th from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 noon to Pacific Time, the Visionary Explorers Group, the online meeting, will be getting together. Also on February 10th from 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 to noon Pacific, Afterlife Discussion Group in Miami, Florida. And February 11th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern, the Afterlife Discussion Group in Sanibel, Florida meets. Our Holiday of the Earth Raffle 2018 is up and running on our website. Win up to 5 medium readings with Forever Family Foundation certified mediums Amy Utzman, Angelina Diana, Dustin Livers, Rebecca Anlo Cicero, and Dave Campbell. The drawing is set for Earth Day, April 22, 2018. Winners are selected randomly by a computer program from consecutive numbers assigned at entry. It's only $5, and that $5 goes a long way to supporting the programming of Forever Family Foundation. And don't miss the early bird rates for our next Afterlife Luncheon on May 6th. Those rates go up on February 1st. This event was a total sellout last October, and the next one promises a very special look at the afterlife as attendees spend a day with two people who say they have all the answers. We have Lloyd Auerbach, one of the world's leading parapsychologists and respected expert on ghost hauntings and poltergeist phenomena. He teams up with Forever Family Foundation certified medium Kim Russo, star of the TV series The Haunting Of, as she will connect with those in spirit who will lead her to their loved ones in the audience. Plan to be at the Hilton Long Island Huntington in Melville, New York, for this full day, which includes a scrumptious luncheon. Our first webinar of the year is set for February 7th at 9 p.m. Eastern and features Dr. Raphael Kelman presenting Kabbalah and Life After Life. The webinars are $6 for members, $20 for non-members. If you were not fortunate enough to sign up in time for the weekend grief retreat that just passed, mark your calendars for August 17 through 19 in 2008, we will be back in Chester, Connecticut for this summer grief retreat. And please, please, please help keep all of our programs going by visiting our website and clicking on the donation button. It's on every single page. Because of the work we do not receive the grants and funding that all other traditional not-for-profits enjoy. You can also help us pay our bills by participating in iGive.com, Amazon.com, Amazon Smile, and great not-for-profits. Back to you, Bob.
And we're back with Dr. Charles Tart, and we're talking about his excellent book, The Secret Science of the Soul. And now, Charles, you probably wish I'm not going to bring this up again, but I can't help it because every time I think of you, and I mean, I've used the story that you've written about in the book about the somewhat famous experiment you did with Mrs. Z, and I always work that into talks because I find it so incredible. So, at the risk of making it seem tedious to you, could you give us a brief synopsis of that dream experiment that you did?
Yeah, it's not tedious to me, Bob, because you know one of the things I not only feel it's my duty to do, but I enjoy doing, is passing along good information that says, you know, don't throw the spiritual out the window. There's something real going on here. Our understanding may be poor, but it's happening. So the good story, our babysitter years ago got to talking to my wife and I, and she had figured out that I was somebody that it was safe to talk to about unusual experiences. I wasn't just going to write her off as crazy. And it seems that ever since she'd been a child, it was common for her to sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and find herself floating near the ceiling, looking down at her physical body, lying in bed. And usually that was pretty much it. The experience would last 5 or 10 seconds, seemed quite real, and then she'd fall asleep and wake up in the morning, go to school. She assumed that's the way it was for everybody. You know, you go to bed, you have a dream, you float near the ceiling for a minute, you go to school next day. Well, she knew by this time that it was not the way everybody experienced sleep, and she'd better keep her mouth shut, or people would think she was nuts. Mm. So she asked me, how do you explain this? And she happened to ask one of the few people in the world who knew something about out-of-the-body experiences. And I told her, well, there are really basically two main theories. The one says you can't possibly have your mind leave your body, so it's just a special kind of dream. You feel awake, and, of course, the dream's creating the illusion that you're floating up near the ceiling, but that's all there is to it. And the other theory is that in some very real sense, your mind is moved up near the ceiling, is looking down. She said, well, how can I tell the difference for myself as to which theory is really correct for me? So I told her, well, okay, try writing numbers 1 to 10 on pieces of paper, put them in a box face down, and after you go to bed at night with the box on the table beside you, reach in without looking, draw one of the sheets of paper at random, turn it over and lay it on the table where you still can't see it in bed. And if you happen to float near the ceiling that night, memorize the number and check it out in the morning. Well, I saw her a few weeks later, and she said, yeah, she'd tried it 8 or 10 times, and she was always right about what the number was. Was there anything else interesting we could do? I'm always tempted to be mean and stop the story at this point. But I was doing sleep research at the time, so I had a sleep laboratory available where I could measure brain waves and heart rate and stuff like that. And I was certainly curious because I knew about near-death experiences, even though they really hadn't hit the culture then. And I wondered, you know, would she show drastic physiological changes like she was coming close to death or what? So she was able to spend several non-consecutive nights in my dream laboratory. And after she was in bed, and once you're wired up this way, it's comfortable, but you can't do more than roll over in bed. The wires are short, but you can stay comfortable, which certainly can't get out of bed. So anyway, after she was in bed, I would go off to my office and open a book that's really good reading if you have trouble get to sleep. It's a million random digits. Yes, somebody really did a book like that years ago. And I would open it at random and copy out 5 random digits and on a piece of paper. And I'd bring them back and put the piece of paper face up on a shelf up near the ceiling. So it was invisible to anybody even walking around in the room, much less in bed with the wires connected for measuring brain waves. And tell her, you know, if you happen to float up high enough near the ceiling, take a look at the number and memorize it. And there's a clock on the wall also nearby. Try to note the time so you can wake up and then tell me exactly what time you had the experience and what the number was. It was a ridiculously miraculous thing to ask anybody to do, but what the heck, you know, I was young and optimistic. Anyway, over the course of her several laboratory nights, she woke up and reported several out-of-the-body experiences and her brainwaves showed an unusual pattern. It wasn't ordinary dreaming, and it wasn't ordinary sleep, and it wasn't ordinary waking. I even checked it with a world expert on sleep research, and we both had 100% agreement. This is weird. I never saw anything like that before. That's the start of knowledge when you know you don't know something. On the one occasion when she said she had been in position to see the number, she correctly told me what the 5-digit number was. Well, I was impressed. Now, I wrote this up. I was still young enough to think it might revolutionize the world, but of course, practically nobody paid any attention to it. And people immediately began attacking me and have ever since the many years ago I did this for claiming to have proved that the mind can leave the body. Well, if they read what I wrote about it, I said, that was her experience, but what this experiment proved to me was you can take something as exotic as a person feeling their soul leaves their body and actually bring it into a laboratory and start studying it in more detail. And incidentally, none of her physiological signs looked like something a doctor would worry about, that she was near death. So this was a safe thing to do. Mm. But the most fun part was people who would eventually think about it and say, did you know what that five-digit number was? And when I admit it, they say, oh, she didn't really leave her body. It was just telepathy.
Right.
Oh, okay.
I had thought
to control for mere telepathy. So that was a very exciting experiment to show that it was possible.
Yeah. So I'm not a statistician, but so what are the odds of guessing a random
100,000 to 1, you know, 1/10 multiplied by itself 5 times.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what I said to you earlier about, was it frustrating? Because it really is quite extraordinary. And I could just see you, the young researcher then thinking, this is the mother lode of research here.
Unfortunately, she then moved across the country, and I lost touch with her, so I wasn't able to do any more. Which actually was a pretty good thing, because if I'd done any more, written any more on this, I probably never would have gotten a respectable job. It was bad enough that I said it was possible to study it without harping on that subject.
Yeah, so, over the years, obviously, we're very interested in survival research. I mean, you never did survival research, per se, but the way I look at it, I mean, your research over the years has been focused on various psi phenomena, and
Bob, let's go back a second.
Yeah.
I'd say that this out of the body experience thing is definitely survival research.
Yeah,
because I think people all through history have occasionally had an out of the body experience like that, and an almost invariable result of it is that afterward the person will say, I don't believe in survival after death. I know I'm going to survive death. It's not a matter of belief. I've experienced being alive outside my physical body. And we can argue about it from the outside, but it's very convincing to people who had it. So
yeah.
We're talking about one of the basis of thinking there's some kind of survival to begin with.
Yeah, and then the way I see it, I mean, your research helped prove that mine was not the same as the brain. So in essence, I mean, your work set the stage for survival of consciousness, because that made it not only plausible but logical. Is that a fair assessment?
And a lot of other people's research too.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was a landmark to be able to bring this into the lab. Almost nobody has done anything with it since, and there were a few attempts to start putting numbers on top of the cabinets in operating rooms, but they didn't seem to realize that when somebody's having a near-death experience and they're going off to talk with God, they're probably not inspecting the top of the equipment to see if there are any numbers on it.
Yeah,
have somebody motivated to do that.
I know. I could just imagine you're this entity and you're floating above the body and you're so excited and you're so curious and you want to. It makes sense.
Excuse me, Lord. I got to look at some numbers over here.
I know. Well, and sometimes scientists don't factor in those situations. We're just about reaching the end of our time. It was a pleasure speaking with you. We were talking with Dr. Charles Tart. The book, which I would recommend you pick up, is The Secret Science of the Soul, How Evidence of the Paranormal is Bringing Science and Spirit Together. There is an Amazon link on our website, to purchase the book. And if you want to learn more about Dr. Tart, you could go on his website, which is Paradigm. No, it's, let's see, it's, yeah, Paradigm, paradigm-sys.com. Or you just Google Charles Tart and you'll find it. Charles?
Can I say one thing, Bob? This new book is actually a paperback of one I did a few years ago called The End of Materialism. But everybody thought that was some kind of philosophy or economics book and didn't realize it was about the implications of parapsychology for spirituality.
Yeah, and The Secret Science of the Soul plays to the mainstream much better. So
I'm waiting for them to come and take my white lab coat away for daring to use the word soul.
Charlie, thanks so much for being with us. We hope to talk to you again soon.
It was a pleasure, Bob.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
You too.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon Ashley Jackson, Robin Murray, Peanut Anton, Fred Folger, Michael Tim, David Haith, Glenn Irwin, Marianne Pierschka, Diane Archangel, Isabel Ginsberg, Lauren Ramnath, Rich LeBly, Helen Montalto, Cynthia Post, Evelyn Ingram, Tina Young, Donna Mello, Matt Mello, Veronica James, Linda Ellis, Eddie Coons, Sandy Rabel, Ed O'Brien, Ralph Giordano, Alex Hanna, and Renata Santarelli. Now let us, as one consciousness, give our energy of loving thought by praying like this: to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away,
and science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.